Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast. I am John Calloway.
And I'm Clayton Hunt.
And today we have with us David Corbin, President and Chief Architect of Dynamic Concepts, a company formed in 1984. He's a Microsoft MVP and ALM Ranger, and a self-described obsessive compulsive developer. Welcome, David.
It's great to be here tonight.
I know from previous conversations that you're big into application lifecycle management. You're big into Agile. You like to discuss improving teams and iterative development and test-driven development. What kind of insights do you have, and what would you like to share with us?
Well, I think my view is influenced heavily by the fact that I started many years ago. In terms of ALM specifically, trying to keep the focus somewhat modern, you know, I was running my own company, developing software, and I had to find ways to be effective. And when ALM hit the market about 12 to 14 years ago, I was like, wow, they're formalizing some of the ideas that I've had, and they've eliminated a lot of the pitfalls I was running into. This stuff is cool.
So for the folks at home that may not be familiar with the ALM acronym and Application Lifecycle Management, what does that entail?
Right. Well, you already defined the acronym, so it's Application Lifecycle Management. And that really is everything from the time there's the concept of, hey, let's write a computer program to do something, or let's create an application, all the way through to the end of life. When are you going to destroy the last backup tapes? What are you going to do when the hardware that's going to exist no longer, the hardware you're running on no longer exists? So it's a very comprehensive environment. Now, these days, you hear a lot of talk about DevOps, and some people say DevOps has replaced ALM. I disagree with that. DevOps is an important part of ALM. Focus started on the developers, started moving into project management. And then, of course, once the program's written, it has to be operational. And so they're now improving that aspect. It's a growing slice of the big ALM picture.
DevOps seems to be another buzz term that has emerged in the last few years. Can you define that for our listeners?
Yeah, well, I think before we can define DevOps, we have to take a step back and look at Agile. And there's really two distinct meanings of Agile. One is there's the Agile Manifesto that's a little over 20 years old. 12 principles and 4 value statements. That's one way to look at Agile. The other way to look at it is a number of highly iterative processes where you work in something called a sprint or an iteration that lasts 2 to 3 weeks, and you're constantly trying to develop an increment of value, develop an increment of value. And developers started really adhering to that. It's not, again, as I said, it's not new. It's over 20 years old. But there was still that, oh, we finished something, let's, quote, throw it over the wall to the operations guys, and they'll make sure it runs. Well, DevOps is saying, hey, it worked good for the developers. Let's get that faster feedback, that better integration in. Let's get the operations people involved in the creation of software so that the software that's written is software that runs well in operations. And so it's, again, tightening feedback loops.
You define yourself as an obsessive compulsive developer. What do you mean by that?
I was very lucky. I got involved in software at a young age. Now, today you hear people getting involved in, you know, writing programs and stuff, preschoolers, literally. I'm also involved in an organization called Coder Dojo. I'd like to talk about that later. But back when I was young, and I'm going back to the 1970s, it was unbelievable for someone, even in high school, to be able to be involved in computers. And I was in middle school, or junior high school, as they called it back then. And I was hooked. It immediately became what I wanted to do. You know, go outside and play? No, I'm going to go beat up on the computer. Go to gym during school? No, I'm going to be in the computer room. And so, yeah, I would say obsessed is pretty accurate, because I still love it today, 40 plus years later.
So back when you got started as a developer, you said you were started in junior high, middle school. How has your career developed? Where did you get your first legit paying gig, and how have you progressed since then?
I'll skip the very early beginning, but upon graduation from high school, I was very lucky to get a summer job. The official title was Junior Electronics Technician Class C, which basically meant a stockroom clerk who knew the difference between a transformer and a transistor. And my job was to take orders of parts from engineers, package them up, and bring them down to the engineering labs. I was on the job about 2 weeks, and I noticed a person trying to boot up something called a DEC PDP-8 computer. And this was back in the days when you actually had to toggle switches on the front panel in order to boot it up and then load a piece of paper, paper tape, into the teletype. And he was very frustrated. So me, at the tender age of 17, "Excuse me, sir, are you having trouble? Anything I could help you with?" And he was like, "Go away, kid!" And I did. Walked back to the room about 2 hours later, delivering another parts order, and he looked over and said, "You know something about this machine? You know anything about this machine?" I said, "A little bit." Now, that little bit meant I had been programming that machine for the past 5 years, starting from junior high school all the way through high school, and had, in fact, been on the school district's payroll before that. Well, he handed me the ops manual, which was about 4 inches thick and held together with binders. I closed it, put it down, and from memory booted up the machine. And he turned to me and said, "What department did you used to work for?" Well, that summer job lasted 15 years.
Have you seen the PDP-8 emulator that you can get for, like, iPad?
Yes, I have seen the PDP-8 emulator. I actually do own a working PDP-8 with three ASR33 teletypes. But I'll confess, I'm good at software, but I'm not good at mechanical hardware. So if anybody knows a teletype repairman out there who's not dead, put them in touch with me. I seriously will pay some real money to get those repaired. But in addition to my real PDP-8, I also have a couple of emulators. I also have something called a spare time gizmos machine that uses the Intercell chip that was made that was PDP-8 software compatible. So I actually have something on my wall, uses an SSD card to simulate disk drives. So it's very nice, very light, but I can get my fix of old school programming and blinky lights.
Nice.
I told you I was obsessive.
All right. You had mentioned Agile a little bit earlier, and I know from past conversations that you're a big proponent of Agile and teacher and sharer of knowledge on anything and everything having to do with Agile. How did you get involved in Agile practices, and what thoughts and ideas do you have around the subject?
That's an interesting one to think about, because it comes in little pieces from so many different directions. The idea of shorter feedback cycles is wonderful. A small increment of delivery. I guess out of all of the principles, the art of maximizing the amount of work not done. When I worked in the defense industry, which is what that company I started with was, there was so much paperwork, there was write documents, reams of documents, that were often done a year or more before the software was actually written. And by the time you got to writing the software, the documents you had created no longer applied. No one ever read them in the form that you spent weeks or months writing them. It was such a waste. Having a codified means where this waste was eliminated through the 12 principles and the four value comparisons just made sense to me. And so I initially bought in, I'd say, to maybe four or five of the 12 principles. And then as I started looking at the others, I said, well, if four or five of these are good, maybe they're not total idiots on the other ones. Maybe these guys, you know, actually do know something. And started looking at them and adopting them. And I really found that if you step back and look at them, get away from a lot of the hype, because, you know any buzzword out there gets so much hype. I hear teams, companies say they've, you know, we've adopted Agile. We've undergone an Agile transformation. And I actually go in when I'm retained as a consultant with a scorecard, and I ask people to vote on certain activities that they've done over the last couple of weeks or months of whether it strongly supports, neutral, mildly inhibits, strongly inhibits, each of the 12 principles. And you'd be surprised how many people say, we're doing Agile, and the majority of their practices are actually in direct contradiction to the manifesto itself.
Yeah, I've had similar experiences. The majority of companies that I've worked at say that they're implementing Agile, specifically Scrum, and it turns out what they're really implementing is chaos. When you're hired in as a consultant to work with a company like that, how do you begin to tackle solving their misunderstanding of the Agile process?
Well, unfortunately, the actual use of a clue bat, a little bat with the word clue that you can hit people over the head with, has been frowned upon since the 1980s. You're not allowed to do that anymore. So it's really getting in and trying to look at some of the things. I think the two biggest issues are the statement of, we welcome changing requirements, even latent development. Changing requirements is a different thing than missing requirements, which is a different thing than wrong requirements. A lot of companies go, oh, we don't need requirements. And then the other one that follows is, we don't do documentation, we're doing agile. We don't do architecture, we don't do design, we're doing agile. Except if you look at the principles, it really says right in there, the best architectures and designs emerge from self-organizing teams. So we'll put aside the self-organizing teams part for a minute. But if architectures and designs are supposed to emerge, how can they not be part of the process? Sometimes that helps with people have a light go on. Looking more towards what is the right amount of work to do and when to do it, the so-called just-in-time. So if I was going to be writing a document and you were going to be reading it, the ideal time for me to finish writing that document is 30 seconds before you open it to read it. If it's not available when you need it, then that's going to cause a delay. I was too late in my delivery. But if it's going to sit there for days, weeks, or months, I was too early. Now, having a safety buffer, of course, makes sense. You don't want to cut everything down to the wire. But just looking at that, I want to do my work such that it will be consumed, made use of, as soon as possible.
Now, do you do a lot of coaching of teams and organizations switching from waterfall to agile practices, or do you find you just do more coaching of those teams and companies that have already adopted agile and just need additional training and guidance?
I've probably hit all of the situations. The most interesting one was a company I was dealing with out in the Midwest a couple of years ago. They were in the insurance processing field. They were not an insurance company, but they processed insurance claims. And most of their work was still done on UNIVAC mainframes. And they had a very heavyweight sequential process, which is often miscalled waterfall. If you go back and look, true waterfall, even when the term was created, was identified as something that didn't exist. There was always the need for a change order. It may take months to get it approved and, you know, be horrendous, but as soon as there's a change order, it's technically not waterfall. Think of waterfall as you really are going over that waterfall in a barrel. Once you go off the edge until you get to the very end, there's no changes. I actually worked on one true waterfall project very early in my career. It was the 70s. It was a military contract. Within 2 weeks of getting the awarded contract, the company realized, the engineering department realized that it couldn't work. It could not physically meet the specs and work. We tried to raise that issue. They were told, build it to spec. We did. Took it out to a military base for final testing. It passed all of the defined tests, and then they wanted to turn it on and put it into operational mode. We advised them against it. They said they were going to do it. We strongly advised them to get behind a set of barriers because when they turned the system on into operational mode, it literally caught fire and partially exploded. And they said, well, it passed the test. You did a good job. It was true waterfall. There was not a single point along the entire development and delivery cycle for any changes. So those I don't hit, but heavyweight sequential processes, things where there's just a lot of stuff weighing down the development. I deal with those companies a lot. I think the hardest ones to deal with, though, are the ones that did an attempt at Agile, had a very bad experience with it, and are gun-shy. The other thing is that's probably the biggest inhibitor is any type of change brings along with it an element of fear. You know, you take a look, people at certain points in their career, you know, I'm no longer the young kid on the block by any means. You can tell that by how long I've been doing this. People in a corporation, especially employees, get to a point in their career where they just want to, you know, kind of heads down, keep doing their job the same way, do it for a few more years, get a pension or some other type of retirement package. So they're looking for that. They don't want to rock the boat. Their primary goal as an individual is stability until I'm done. And when you start saying things like, oh, we're going to not have any managers. The word manager will be stricken, which is a pretty hardline case, but there are some companies that are doing that. The person who has the title manager is going, but what does that mean to me? The same thing happens, you know, on a related note, with the changing role of QA. When you say, you know, we're changing that around, people go and say, what's going to happen to my job? I was at a Lean Coffee in Brandon. It was the one in Brandon last Friday. And most of the people who were there were people from a segmented QA department, and the company was integrating, and they were all fearful about losing their jobs. And that became the focus of the entire talk. You know, lean coffee is supposed to be 5 minutes and then 2 minute extensions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, now this became about a half hour because it kept getting a Roman thumbs up. Everyone wanted to keep talking about it. But it really wasn't. And at the end, they were actually excited. It was more like, wow, we can be influencing things earlier where there's a possibility that things will be changed and made better. We're not going to be spending as much time doing the tedious work. But when they came in, it was all about fear. And so if you're going to do a transformation, my professional opinion is you have to look at each of the involved parties, the management, both the hands-on managers at the lower levels, all the way up to the CEOs, the workers in, you know, various roles, and try to find things that you can focus on. Here is how you will benefit. Here is how you will benefit. And if I tell you, if I ask you to do something because that other person will benefit, you may say that's nice, and you're a kind of altruistic person, so you say that's nice. But that doesn't have the same thing as saying you will benefit. You will have a better day at work. You will leave work feeling maybe not great, but not totally despondent, totally frustrated. And that'll flow into probably having a better evening, a better night's rest, getting up in the morning, and coming back into work with a better frame of mind. And that is a phenomenal feedback loop.
In your experience, what works better? Is it coming in and just changing the entire company to Agile all in one fell swoop? Or is it adding some tiny part of the process or slowly updating the company?
I'm going to defer that for a half second because you said what's the best way. And a term that really annoys me, even though you didn't exactly use it, is the term best practices. I don't believe they exist. What's good for one company could be the worst thing in the world for another company. What's good for a given environment in 2016 could be the worst thing in 2018. So, taking away the word best, I really do think it varies tremendously. Sometimes an organization-wide change is more effective. That can either be done in a very abrupt form, which I've done one or two, where the company was about to go under. Literally, they were failing hard. And if something wasn't done, they were going to lose major contracts, et cetera, et cetera. Other times, doing it gradually, coming up with a longer-term vision and lots of small steps, you know, the journey of 1,000 steps. In other cases, it's often better start with a small prototype group. Let them get improve and show tangible results. I've done a couple of companies where, you know, that's what happened. Their attitude towards agile iterative development was negative. Got permission to work with one team, worked with them. They were starting to show markedly better results. One or two other teams started looking, going, hey, they're doing pretty good. How can we get in on this? And over the course of probably close to a year, most, but not all of the teams got involved. But there were a few holdout teams. And then what happened with the last two holdout teams at this one particular client was one of them, the person in charge left. He retired early, going back to my previous statement. And the other guy was basically told, you will change and adopt this because you're the only team that's underperforming or we will make changes. And he did. And about 6 months later, it's like, wow, this stuff really works. So now that's not to say I don't have horror stories, you know, to go along with it, but I like to focus on the positive. But, you know, show me it works, show me tangible results in a small case is usually the best way to handle it, in my experience, if upper management is hesitant. If upper management has your buy-in, you're good. Now, you mentioned Agile and Scrum, and the two are intertwined, but they are distinct. Remember, Scrum is a specific framework upon which you can build an actual process. Scrum is not a process in and of itself, but it does have a very fixed core set of rules that make it. This is the Scrum framework.
So more on to teams and the QA folks and getting integrated teams. It seems that these days there's more focus on quality and delivering quality. How do you coach teams or facilitate teams in delivering more and better quality?
That's a loaded compound question. So I want to start off with the question of what is quality? And because I find that to be a very interesting question. Now, if you remember back, well, probably 15 years ago or so, maybe a little bit longer, there were all the computer trade shows, right? There was Comdex, there were dozens of them. It seemed like there was a trade show somewhere in the country every week. And I was at a lot of them. I was at one and they were having a panel discussion right on the trade show floor, which was not uncommon. And I was just hanging out there to listen to this panel discussion because it was on software quality. But one of the speakers didn't show. And I was asked, could I step up and fill up the seat? And I said, no, I'm not getting up with these guys. Those guys, they know what they're talking about. There were some luminary names. I'm not going to mention names, but they were well-known names. I was finally convinced to get up there. I figured I'd sit quietly, realizing at the time, you should know, I never sit quietly. So different people were bringing up software quality. And it was like, well, if you have software quality means you have to have this. And other people were saying, but you could have that and not have quality. And a thought popped into my head. I was like, maybe we're doing this wrong. Maybe instead of defining what is software quality, can we define what is a lack of software quality? And then if those things are absent, you can imply that there is software quality. And so I started thinking about all the different things, and you can probably be racking them up in your head right now, even as we're talking about, all the different things that indicate a lack of quality. And I simplified it down. And this is one of the few flashes over my career that I think really was insightful. And was every one of them had the key word surprise. Surprise, the project's over budget. Surprise, it's not done on time. Surprise, this part doesn't function. Because if you were planning for it to cost more money, you would have dealt with it. If you were planning for it to take more time, you would have adjusted your schedule or your feature set. If you had known that a feature wasn't working, you might have held off release, you might have removed a feature, you might have at least put out release notes. All of the indications of a lack of quality are surprises. So if we want to improve software quality, we have to remove surprises. And the way to remove surprises is to get people communicating and collaborating better. And one of the things about better collaboration is it happens in real time or something close to real time. You know, I remember years and years ago as a child, I was a chess player, still play occasionally. And we used to do chess by mail. You'd make a move, you'd mail it, and you know, that person would get it a week later, they'd make a move, mail it back. So it was a 2-week cycle per move. Your game could take 6 months. Quite a different experience than sitting down at a chessboard with a chess clock. If you look at software development, where I'm bringing this back in is the old school was very much like chess by mail. There was a big lag between the different people making the moves. Now, if you're a developer and you're writing a piece of code and you finish that code, you put it in your source control repository, whatever that may be, and then a month later, someone runs some test and finds a defect, I'm sure you've moved on. You've got other code in your head right now. You have some vague recollection of what you wrote, but you probably can't tell me what's on line 25 of a given file. But if you can write that code and get feedback about defects within the next 30 minutes, next hour, next 2 hours, it's still very fresh. It'll be a lot cheaper and easier for you to fix it, or at least change it to see if that fixes it and get the feedback. So we want to take the so-called QA department and get the processes that they're doing, the testing they're doing, integrated in with the development as close as possible. So on the topic of QA, the first thing to realize is that I believe QA to be a misnomer as it's used in most organizations today. If you go back a number of years ago and look across many different fields, there were always two departments. There was quality assurance and quality control. QC, quality controlled, was the part of the organization that did all the testing. QA was the group that sat at a much higher level and established the general policies, procedures, and the auditing mechanisms to make sure that those things were being, A, being done, that was the easy part, and B, were being effective. So assuring quality, being effective, having good overall processes, is radically different than running tests. But most QA departments today, or as I say, so-called QA departments, focus merely on creating and running tests. So let's talk about that testing part. There's really two distinct realms of testing. And I'm waiting for people to think manual and automated. No, that's not where I'm going yet. There's what's called definitive tests. That's any test where you can write down in some form, do this, check that, do this, check that, do this, check that. You can write a procedure that you can give to someone else to execute. The other side is exploratory. Here, go play with that. You know, here's a new feature. Go evaluate it. Give me your positive and your negative feedback. Professionally, I believe that all definitive tests should be automated. No exceptions. People say it's too expensive to automate. I say drive down your cost of automation. There are some very good tools and techniques out there. One of my favorites these days, especially in .NET land, but it's not exclusive to that, is a concept. The tools I'm about to talk about are, is use SpecFlow. So you can write your tests in English in a given when then format. It's called Gherkin. Then have automatic generation that binds that into models. Then use Selenium for your automation. And you can actually have your business analysts writing your test cases at the time they're writing the requirements, so that they're in place as the developer's writing the code. So you can automate all your tests. That frees up the people who were previously stuck running those tests to have time to go look at things. I was recently doing a presentation on something that I found a much more complicated version of a client, so I distilled it and simplified it for the presentation, where I had this little ID card that flashed up and had a couple of drop-down boxes, and there was some buggy behavior. The person's gender was shown, M for male, F for female, and if you did certain things, that little field would change. It wouldn't fail any definitive test, because who in their right mind is going to write, oh, if the person has this security level, or when you change security level from clear, from secret to top secret, make sure their gender doesn't change. So, you know, you're not going to ever write those types of tests. So in this one real client engagement, they had that type of a bug. It wasn't that simple, but that type of a bug. Some of the testers had seen the defect, but they never failed the test because it didn't violate any of the test criteria. Had they instead been told to go look at this and provide feedback, they would have caught that. So once you get the people able to be doing exploratory testing, being able to use their brains, you have a lot of benefits there. With the tests being defined at the same time as your requirements or your user stories, your product backlog items, whatever terminology you want to use, you've shortened the cycle so developers are writing code and seeing if tests pass or fail.
Right. That sounds vaguely similar to your military example earlier, that based on the criteria, they were passing and they were pushing forward as if there weren't an issue.
Exactly, because you're always thinking about the happy paths. And yes, even error handling is a happy path, right? If you leave this field blank, you should get an error message. Oh, I'm happy I got the error message. People who write tests are thinking about the happy path. It's normal. It's how we deal with life. You're looking at the things you're sort of already preparing for.
So that leads us into more of the team's owning quality, especially as we integrate the QA folks into Scrum teams or into the development teams. What are your thoughts on test-driven development as a practice, as a discipline?
As a general rule, I really love TDD. I do believe that at the minimum, tests should be written, and I'm going to talk about unit tests now, very small, very granular tests being written at the same time the code is being written. I'm not a purist in the test must be written first. You know, I'm going to create an empty class with a method that throws a not implemented exception, write a test, that test will fail because it's going to get a not implemented exception, then I will refine the code. But I will have that skeleton there, so my test has something to call. So some purists get upset with me with that. But you know, once that started, yes, create a test, write the minimum amount of code. And that typically means write really lousy code quickly. Test passes, write another test. Now, I'm also a big fan of pair programming. Unfortunately, I also have to admit that about 85% of all the pair programming environments I've seen over the years have devolved. They have something that's the worker-observer pattern. One person doing the work and the other person sitting there going, okay, I feel useless. If you couple with TDD, there's something called ping-pong TDD, and there's a couple of videos out there on the web that are really great about it. But the basic idea would be you and I are sitting down in a pair programming environment. So we're in front of one computer. We each have a keyboard. We can see the monitors, but you don't even want the delay of having to slide the keyboard back and forth and rearrange the mouse. I'm going to write that one test that fails and then lean back. You're going to write just enough code to make it pass and then write a test that fails and lean back. I got to get that test to pass and not break any other tests and write another test. Back and forth, back and forth. If you get into some people who are competitive, and this varies a lot based on culture, right? You're going to do this in New York, you're going to have a lot of things very competitive. You do it in other locales, some locations around the globe where people are more concerned about other aspects of their life than, I got to win. it doesn't have the dramatic effect, but people start just like, I've got to do this faster, I've got to do this faster. And it has some amazing results. Think about it. If you're one of those types of people who do this thing called exercise, you know, like you go out and you run somewhere or even you lift weights.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. I've heard of people doing this. But no, seriously, weightlifting. You don't try to do weights continuously. You don't sit there in the gym and say, I'm going to sit there and curl this weight at an even repetition rate for the next 4 hours. You do sets and repetitions. You do a couple of reps and you take a little bit of a break. Do a couple of reps, take a little bit of a break. That pair programming in Ping Pong TDD gives you that same thing. You get incredibly intense for a period of 3 to 5 minutes. And then you come back and your hands are off the keyboard. You're not worried about where semicolons go, but you're thinking, how is he going to fix that? What design patterns will he use? And also, what am I going to do? What is he going to throw at me as the next logical test? So you're still engaged. But it's a different part of your brain that's engaged. And for teams that I've done this with, you'd be amazed what the output can be in the course of one day compared to other techniques.
Now, it was actually Clayton that introduced TDD to me a number of years ago when we were working at a small startup. I had joined the company and it was expressed that the company wanted to start practicing TDD. It wasn't until Clayton came on board and really introduced the entire team to the concept and adopted the practice as a team. And I would say that it took us probably 3 to 6 months to really feel comfortable and be feel as productive as before and maybe not want to strangle one another in frustration. Have you had any experience introducing TDD or pair programming or ping pong TDD to teams?
Your experience sounds perfectly normal, although I would say the time frame is at the higher end. Again, many things vary. There are no universal answers. But I've always found it best where if you're going to be undergoing something transformative, something really new, get a professional coach who's got two advantages. One, they have the experience, so you're not, kind of stumbling around. And second, by being a outside observer to some degree, they can avoid some of the political issues. You know, if I'm an employee of a company, I still remember when I worked for someone else. There were certain things you just didn't say to your boss as a normal rule because you wanted to protect your job. But there were things you felt needed to be said. If you're an outside consultant and that thing really does need to be said, there are ways to get it said. You know, hey, it could mean ending a contract. Over the years, there have been a couple of contracts, not many, but a couple, where I've sat down and told people, at the management level and said, this is the way you want to go. That's fine. It's your company. It's your choice. But I do not believe that will be effective. And if you want to go that way, I'm not the right person to help make that effective for you. And I disengage and sometimes have even found an alternate supplier to help them on the road they want to go on. But that independence has a lot of value on all sides. Now, on the TDD, one of the things I think is probably the hardest stumbling back is, you remember there's always the saying, red-green refactor. And I've seen too many places where it's red, green, red, green, red, green, red, green, leave it alone. I am a big believer in refactoring. Refactoring as a distinct activity, a regular activity. So if you're doing, for example, ping pong TDD, it may be 45 minutes to an hour of that ping ponging, and then sit back and stop and say, oh my gosh, what have we written? Look at this crap. But take what you've learned and say, how can we make this a better design? How can we integrate this with the other parts? How can we bring this into cohesion? Ah, good. That looks good. And that may take an hour. Get that checked in. But at least when you're doing that design work, remember, designs emerge. Architectures emerge as per the Agile principles. As that design is emerging, you've got the safety net of the test cases already proven to work for the simple, albeit not the cleanest, code. So refactoring, I believe, is key.
Now, you've mentioned design and design patterns. A number of years ago, it was asked of me when we were discussing design patterns, what are the design patterns that a developer must know? That was uh, that question seemed a bit odd to me at the time, particularly coming from the individual that it came from. But, you know, for younger developers or developers that haven't been exposed to design patterns as written in the Gang of Four book, how do you go about defining and speaking to or sharing design patterns, or what is your thought around the subject?
You know, the book by the Gang of Four was transformative. It was also had effects that were never intended by at least some of the authors. Some of them have commented on it specifically. The patterns in the book were designed to be samples. They were never meant to be these super patterns, the canonical beliefs that you should all follow. As human beings, we are pattern-based, okay? We want to do more of the things that we know work well, and we want to avoid the things that we have experienced don't work well. We want to have short-form ways of communicating things. I'm sure anyone who has a close circle of friends or an intimate relationship, you have certain short terms that you can use that convey a lot of meaning in two or three words, and the other party really knows exactly what you're talking about without you having to do paragraphs of explanation. That's when it's applied to designs. That's what design patterns are. Nothing more, nothing less. A short phrase, a longer description for those who aren't familiar, when it should be strongly considered and when it should not be. Things like Singleton Factory or any of the others, basically meaningless. Don't worry about memorizing those. Look through what you're doing. What are the things you do that work well for you? What are the things that don't do well? When design patterns started to emerge about the same time as a formal name and a focus, certain sharing technologies weren't quite as available as they are today. So I used to have each team actually keep a notebook, a three-ring binder notebook. They print out pages, hole punch them and put them in there, about what were the patterns that they used in their code. You went looking at a piece of code and you found something that was really a mess of spaghetti or something, you know, really bad. And then you started looking through the bigger code base and finding it three or four places. That is a pattern.
So it's the patterns as they define them.
As they define them.
On another podcast that I listened to, they had a guest. It was either Kent Beck or Martin Fowler. And they were talking about how they went through an experiment where for a certain amount of time, they didn't write a line of code unless they could describe and understand the pattern that they were choosing to use to write that line of code. Even if it was a pattern that they were inventing, they wanted to make sure that they understood everything that they were doing to go into their code. And I found that to be kind of interesting, just to be able to go and look at the way you're writing your code and assemble these things that you have found that are helpful for solving the class of problems that you come across all the time.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Except I would say from a pragmatic standpoint, for most teams, that pre-thought, especially if they're not familiar with it, could become way too much overhead. So it's a very similar concept, but saying, take a look at what you're inherently doing and identify the pattern. So get to the same endpoint, but don't try to do it up front until you get really good at it. Once you've got a book of patterns, it's just slightly different than a book of secrets, but it is kind of your secret sauce, right? This is the things that we do that work well. Now you can start saying, oh, we're doing something new. Well, this sounds like that, and those things work well. These sound like that. And so you can start working on, we're going to build this design. We're going to start this implementation by reviewing our existing known patterns and seeing which ones of them we can leverage. But I think, you know, the talk that you're talking about, and I believe I've heard that same podcast, of doing it up front, those guys are experts. And, you know, they prove the point, it's valuable. But it's probably too rigorous, I guess is a good word, for most practical teams.
Yeah, it almost goes against the design emerges phrase that you used earlier.
But as an experiment, you know, it's a great thing. But, you know, one of the other ones I love talking about, you know, is, you know, we've mentioned a couple of times, feedback loops, getting things in shorter and shorter cycles. So I found this shows up in a number of different ways. One thing is, you know, branching. Okay. If you have code that's going into branches, it's inherently isolated. That's the purpose of the branch. Now, what happens if you're working on a feature branch, I'm working on the primary dev branch, and I decide to do some refactoring? I've already said refactoring early and often. So I'm going to rename some methods, move some methods into other namespaces. I'm going to reorganize some files to put my methods at the top and my privates at the bottom. I'm just going to be refactoring, cleaning up my code. and you're off working in a branch. Now you go to merge in the 10 lines of code that you actually changed. Are you going to have a good experience?
Not if you're second.
Exactly. So the isolation of branching has a potential downside. If there are ways, and I believe there are, to mitigate those, for example, using things like feature flags, where you can work on a single code base, but turn on and off what you're doing. You can work together closer. If you do things such as implementation first, which is so simple in concept, has some details. But here's a great experiment. Go out to a couple of developers you know, and say they're doing a simple ASP.NET MVC page. And you tell them, I need you to add a button on this screen that when clicked, it will do something. What do you think the first thing they're going to do is?
Go to the view and add the button.
Yep. What do you think I'm going to propose should be the last thing they do?
Go to the view and add the button.
Exactly. Because I can write a whole new set of class methods, whole new set of classes, whole new set of methods on them, have good unit testing on them, have integration testing on them. I can mock the database. I can do all that work right in main, almost zero risk. Nothing is ever zero risk. Recompiling the same version of your source control is not zero risk. There could be operating system updates that have occurred in the meantime. Some compilers are non-deterministic in memory layout. So there's always a risk, but you can really get that risk down as close to zero as possible. You know, get it down to the same level of the odds of winning Powerball and Mega Millions in the same week. Still not zero, but I wouldn't count on it. But you start working in that pattern so you can work more closely together. So if you start minimizing your branches, you start looking at how fast can we start doing check-ins. Now, there's something that I've adapted. Very few things that I've done are original. They're usually things that have been combined and put together in new ways. But for writers, people who are authors, there's an approach out there called the Pomodoro method. And the Pomodoro method basically says, work really hard with no interruptions for 22 and a half minutes with a timer set. When the timer goes ding, stop working, get up and take care of life for 7.5 minutes, and then get your butt back in the chair and work for another 22 and a half minutes. I tried applying that to software development and found that the concept was great, but the cycle was too short. What I found statistically to work very well is to just cut the frequency in half, double the time period. Spend 45 minutes, heads down, working. No email checks, no tweets, no Facebook, no nothing. No answering the phone, nothing. I am working. Finish that 45 minutes, heads up, look around, take care of what you need to take care of. I go so far as when I'm working at certain client sites where they're having me not so much on the coaching, but they want me to crunch out things like, we need a testing framework, right one. I actually have a little plastic figurine that goes up on the corner of my cubicle. If it's sitting up on the corner of my cubicle, there's a notepad on the desk right at the entrance of my cubicle. Write your name and, you know, one, two words about what it is, and I will get back to you as soon as my work is done and I take him off. If he's not up there, feel free to come in. I'm in that 15-minute window. People go, like, you can get away with that? But what about things that are important? I'm like, okay, 45-minute cycle. Mean time is going to be 22 and a half minutes. What's the odds of something like, you know, occurring that's really going to kill you if it takes 22 and a half minutes? I found that the reason everybody, well, not everybody, but the reason most people yell, I need this now, this is top priority, is because somewhere in their history, they went up to someone and said, I need something. The person said, I'll get back to you and you'll have it by Friday. Friday came and the person came back up and said, I'm here, I'm ready for it. And they go, oh, I didn't get to it. It got buried. I never told you that I wasn't going to get to it. I never updated you. I didn't collaborate with you. I'm just going to surprise you. There's that word surprise. And you're not getting what you want. So what does the person do as a defense mechanism if that happens a couple of times? Not I need it Friday, even if Friday's when I really need it. I need it now. I'm not leaving your office until it's done. It's artificial. It's a defense mechanism. It's understandable, but it's still artificial. Get these 45-minute cycles. Now, interesting enough, if you look at any type of Agile or Scrum work planning, you have your backlog of work. You have hours either of estimated time or remaining time, depending upon what terminology you're going to use. And you never should be booking your developers for 8 hours of work a day. What's the typical number? 6 hours a day. 6 hours out of 8 hours is 3/4. 45 minutes out of every hour is 3/4. So there's a matchup there. And if you look at the alternatives, what are you going to do? I'm going to come in the morning, I'm going to work for 6 hours without interruption, and then I'll take care of 2 hours of the other stuff. Ain't going to happen. Okay, I'll come in, I'll get all my interruptions out of the way for 2 hours, and then I'll get the other stuff. Ain't gonna happen. They gotta be mixed. But having a repetitive cadence, iterations, sprints, a repetitive cadence, right? Regardless of what your interval is, you want it to be repetitive. Get that into your daily work habit. At least give it a try. I'm not saying it works for everybody. Again, no universal solutions. But this one really works nice.
Yeah, I've tried the Pomodoro technique. It's actually one I really like. I do a slightly different work rest cycle. I'd usually do 25 minutes with a 5 minute rest, and then every 4 hours I take a 15 minute rest. But doing that, I found that I can only really complete about 7 to 8 of my Pomodoros, which equates to about 4 hours of work in a typical 8 hour workday. Any more than that, and my next day actually suffers. And I think it's just because I'm full on heads down getting work done for 4 whole hours a day, as opposed to sort of kind of getting some work done for 8 hours a day. Have you experienced the same thing, or can you consistently knock out 8 cycles of your Pomodoros?
Well, we never go with what I can knock out, because remember, I am the obsessive compulsive developer. But in terms of talking with, you know, many other developers, I think you're probably very statistically right. The question I would find interesting, if you have any way of determining it, is if you look back at how much you accomplished per day before you adopted that Pomodoro and that scheduling. Again, the 45-15 is something I have found to work. I find it to be a good statistical starting point. But if you then look at what you're outputting now, maybe only doing 4 or 5 Pomodoro cycles, you know, and only doing 4 hours, quote, of real work. Are you producing more? Are you producing the same amount at a better quality?
Yeah, I'm way, way more productive. Like 2 or 3 times the amount of work that I would normally get done.
So that's a win.
Oh, yeah. It's just the number is a lot smaller than you would think you would get done in a day. You know, like you were saying, you estimate 6 hours, even though you're at work for 8 hours. But really, mine's more like 4 hours. And that's a good day.
Yeah.
And you've still said that your boss says you're more productive than your hours may claim to be, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He thinks I work overtime.
It's all about being effective. That's really what it is. You know, I have some guidelines based on experience, not just my own, but dealing with close to 100 different organizations over the years. But it's just guidance. It's finding out what works for you is my strongest advice. There's some certain things that probably are not good ideas to try. But even those are probably not good. I can never say they're horrifically bad universally for every team on the globe.
Trying to avoid the best practices term, there seems to be some commonality about finding out what works for you, whether it's choosing a working model, a Scrum or a Kanban, whether it's choosing Git or TFS in VSTS, or whether it's choosing a particular pattern. How do you go about making those determinations when approaching new teams, new clients, new developers?
Well, first of all, I am biased. No human being can claim they're not. So I'm very upfront about what I'm biased towards. And that, you know, helps select, because I want to provide value to my clients. I mean, that's the reason for doing it. Making money is nice too, but as a small businessman, you know, it's all about client satisfaction, because one bad client can ruin 30 years worth of work. So I make sure up front that there is at least a partial match in direction. I don't try to, you know, ever fight someone. Oh, you think vendor X is correct and I'm going to force you into vendor Y? No. You know, I like Microsoft TFS and VSTS. I just mentioned at the beginning, I am one of the Visual Studio ALM Rangers. I think it is a phenomenal product. It's not without its flaws. As a ranger, we try to produce power tools and add-ons and extensions that help mitigate some of those problems. But it's not perfect. Team Foundation version control, TFVC, the classic centralized version control, versus Git. I love Git if your work is really distributed. Remember, Git was originally developed to handle Linux itself. So what do you have? You have Linus with his master repo. You have how many different major distributions? It's cut down, but right, you have Red Hat, SUSE. There used to be, what, 15 or 20 major distributions? Then you have vendors like Dell who make their own variation based on. They're very loosely coupled. They're very distributed, but they wanted some communication mechanism between them. Now you take a look at your average corporate team. You want, hey, if you do some work, I want to be able to know about it as soon as practical. We want to be able to be sharing. We want to be able to collaborating very quickly in real time. There can be times where those two are somewhat at odds. Yes, you can configure Git to make it act very centralized, only having one remote, doing everything, generate a pull request, and automate it. You know, you can coerce it into being a sort of centralized, but if you're going to coerce it into being a centralized, why not use a centralized? On the other hand, if you want distributed, why try to fight a centralized system to achieve distributed goals? The most frustrating thing I've had on the Git TFEC was a little over a year now. I was in one client, and they had just switched from TFEC for many years to Git. And why? Oh, it was an edict from management. Okay, up to management. Why? Oh, it was an edict from the CTO. Okay, CTO. Why? I read an article that says we'll hire better programmers because good programmers like Git. So we switched to Git to be able to hire better programmers. Remember my mention of a Clubat? That was one of those days I really wished you were still allowed to use them. There's many good reasons for going to Git. I'm not saying there aren't. That was not one of them.
Getting to decisions, it sounds like you're really asking why repeatedly to find out the reasons for the choices and the reasons for the decisions that are made.
Like always asking why and not just verbally. Okay. One of the things I like to do, and you know, it depends on the engagement, right? If I'm engaged to migrate somebody from, you know, X to VSTS, it's a well-defined thing. That's what we're doing. But if they're looking for the more general transformations, first thing I like to do is just sit and work with the team for up to a week. You know, just come in. Let me, you know, be an extra guy on your team. I may not be able to help out much if there's too much business domain, but one side effect of having done this for so many years is that I've worked in just about every vertical market. You know, you want to talk about, you know, computers and entertainment. You know, I designed the control surface, one of the first fully automated digital soundboards. The big type that the, you know, big musicians use. Mariah Carey used to use those boards and used to come into the factory quite often. I've done spaceborne systems, military systems, embedded medical devices, infusion pumps. If you get a high contrast X-ray that's using barium, there's a good chance that that's running some software that I was involved in writing. So I have a very light general knowledge of a lot of business domains, so I can speak the language. So it's listening. So sometimes it's prompting with, you know, an explicit why. But at times it's looking, or it's talking about things and, you know, just looking at people's expressions. You know, when are people looking down and looking at their phones? When are they looking up and going, huh? When do you see them look away? It really is. It's all about communication and finding out both what they think they need, what their perceptions are, what the optics are, and then trying to look down beneath it and guess. I'm bluntly, it's a guess, but it's an educated guess based upon experience and say, what are the fundamentals? What things, you know, is there something that's a disconnect between what I'm hearing and what I'm seeing and what I experienced in the past? And that's something that only comes with, you know, me having made a lot of mistakes over decades. I've probably made more mistakes than any developer you'll interview on this show if you take it over the total course of their career.
Mistakes and learning from those mistakes.
Right. I've made them. I tried to avoid making the same mistake twice. And the ones I've made, hopefully I can coach you so that you don't have to ever experience them.
On that note, I'm not sure if you've had much opportunity to poke around the six-figure developer blog, but we like to write about, you know, helping developers grow their career. What advice would you have for those just starting out or looking for advancement?
Connect with as many people as you can in as many different modalities as you can. You can find out great stuff on the internet. There's plenty of great forums. There's plenty of podcasts and other media. But there's nothing that beats face-to-face for certain things. So and down here in Florida and in many other cases, very rich meetup group. I mean, you could literally go to a meetup almost every morning and every night, you know, of the month. I would say even that for me is a little, you know, too obsessive. When I'm in town and I'm not traveling, I'm probably at about 8 to 10 meetups a month. I travel a lot to clients, so, you know, attendance is sporadic. Learn from as many sources as you can. Establish some people that you trust, but heed advice that goes back 50 years ago of trust but verify. Don't blindly believe anyone. Don't even blindly believe me when I'm telling you not to blindly believe anyone. And that should make your head spin. But it's true. Listen, gather, and experiment. Experiment, experiment, experiment. You know, we touching back, you know, we've talked on many different topics, but they're all really related. If we talk back, you know, on both Agile and Scrum, one of the key ceremonies is at the end of each iteration, having something called a retrospective, a looking back. And there's three elements to that. What do we do good that we want to do more of? What do we do poorly that we want to do less of? Those two usually aren't a problem. The third one, what are we going to try differently the next sprint? And it frustrates me so much when I go into a client, or even if I'm at a meetup and talking to someone, I ask, how did you work this past sprint? Not what did you work on, but how did you work? And they tell me, I go, okay, what about the sprint before that? No, it was the same thing. Well, what about the sprint before that? You know, maybe they just had, you know, oh, same thing. I'm like, you guys are failing. Try something new every single sprint, something small. You know, some of the things that I found are interesting. You have your developer daily meeting, your so-called stand-up or your daily scrum, first thing in the morning. Move it to late morning. Try your first sprint or two. See what happens when people are rushing to come in and get there for the sprint and they haven't had a chance really to collect their thoughts. But at the same time, they're not distracted by the day's activities versus they've had a chance to get settled. They got the latest and greatest information. You know, maybe they found out things from operations from overnight. Maybe there's emails from a client that came in. And so they're in a better position to provide more timely information on an 11 o'clock meeting. Who knows? But if you don't try it, how will you ever know? So try things. Try small things that you can afford to have fail. Fail fast. And then let these successes accumulate.
All right. Well, great, David. Do you have any upcoming engagements you'd like to speak about?
Well, things are, you know, always busy. I'm always running around. I'm heading up to Chicago in a week. And then from there, heading out to Maui, I'm going to have a new grandchild, a new granddaughter. And
congratulations.
Thank you. So I'm looking for speaking engagements and other contacts while out there. The biggest thing I have that's confirmed on my calendar is VS Live, Visual Studio Live, has a number of conferences around the country throughout the year. And I am confirmed for Redmond, Washington in August. I don't have the exact dates handy.
Fantastic. So we'll be looking for you in coming months. Are there any other items that you'd like to announce or speak about before we call it a night?
Yeah, well, one thing I'd like to announce here is that, you know, Dynamic Concepts and myself have been offering training, mentoring, and the like on ALM and related topics for many years. And our business model has almost always been be retained by a fairly large corporate client, go in and help their developers. And at the end of last year, I was sitting around talking with some people, and realize that while there's plenty of great meetups, little one-day boot camps and seminars that are introductory in nature, the type of training that was being given in these corporate settings really wasn't available in many cases to small and medium-sized businesses that have a couple of developers. They can't afford to bring in a consultant. There's a couple of organizations in Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, but sending someone there. So we announced just recently that Dynamic Concepts is going to be offering open enrollment, you know, fee-based educational courses ranging from 1 to 3 days on given topics. Our first courses are announced for June 8th and 20th. They're about establishing good project management techniques with Agile and Scrum as a framework. We'll be using Visual Studio Team services for all the labs. There's almost 3 hours worth of hands-on labs. And so I'm really excited and looking forward to that. And that'll be held. One session on the 8th is in downtown St. Petersburg, and then the other session on the 20th will be up in Temple Terrace. And we're going to be consistently offering new courses and other things. These were just our first ones out of the gate.
Well, thank you very much, David Corbin, President and Chief Architect, Dynamic Concepts. This has been the Six Figure Developer Podcast. I am John Calloway.
And I'm Clayton Hunt.
Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.